Chapter 19. Years have passed. I live an unsettled life, hopping from town to town. I avoid connections or ties, and focus on developing my fighting abilities and developing my legacies. Invisibility was followed by telekinesis, and in recent months I've discovered a new ability. I can control and manipulate the weather. I use that legacy sparingly, as it's an easy way to attract unwanted attention. It manifested months ago, in a small suburb outside Cleveland. I had been following a lead on one of the guard that didn't go anywhere, and, discouraged, I was ambling back towards my motel, sipping an iced coffee. My leg burst into searing pain, and I dropped my drink on the ground. My third scar. Three was dead. I fell to the ground in pain and in rage, and before I knew what was happening, the sky above me filled with clouds. A full-on lightning storm followed. I am in Athens, Georgia now. It's a cool little city, one of the best I've passed through in the past couple years. College students everywhere. I've got a bit of a vagabond roughness to my appearance that stands out in suburban areas, but surrounded by college-age hippies and music nerds and hipsters, I don't look quite so unusual. This makes me feel safe. All of my leads have gone dead, and I have yet to discover one of my kind, but I know it is coming. Time to assemble the guard. If my legacies are developing at this rate, I am certain the same is true of the others like me. There will be signs soon. I can feel it. I am patient, but excited. I am ready to fight. I wander the street, sipping the dregs of an iced coffee. It's become my drink of choice. I have resorted to pickpocketing to finance my appetites, but it's become so easy that I never have to outright fleece anyone. I just take a few bucks here or there to get by. I am suddenly knocked by a gust of wind practically off my feet. For a second, I think I've lost control, that it's my own power that caused it. But the wind ends as soon as it began, and I realize it did not come from me. But it has swung the door of another cafe open. I almost keep walking, but my eye is caught by an open computer terminal at the back of the cafe. I use internet cafes to keep tabs on the news, looking for items that could turn into a lead on my kind. Doing it makes me feel closer to Katerina. I have become my own, Sepan. I chuck my empty cup in the trash outside and step into the air-conditioned chill of the place. I take my seat and begin scanning the news. An item from Paradise, Ohio catches me. A teenager was seen leaping from a burning building, new to town, named John. The reporter mentioned how hard it was to get solid information on him. I stand up so quickly, I send the chair flying out from under me. I know in an instant he's one of us, though I don't know how I know. Something in that gust of wind. Something about the way butterflies are now fluttering in my stomach, brushing my insides with their wings. Perhaps this recognition is a part of the charm, something that lets us know that a hunch is more than a hunch. I know. I just know. My heart races with excitement. He's out there. One of the guard. I run out of the cafe and onto the street. Left. Right. I'm not sure which way to turn, how to get to Paradise as quickly as I can. I take a deep breath. It's beginning. I think it's finally beginning. I laugh at my own paralysis. I remember that the bus station is a mile down the road. I make a habit of memorizing all transport routes into and out of any town I visit, and the bus route out of Athens returns to my mind. The beginning of a plan to get to paradise starts to develop. I turn and begin the walk to the station.
Nine's Legacy. Chapter 1. There are rules for hiding in plain sight. The first rule, or at least the one that Sander repeats most often, is, don't be stupid. I'm about to break that rule by taking off my pants. Spring in Chicago is my favorite season. The winters are cold and windy, the summers hot and loud, the springs perfect. This morning is sunny, but there's still a forbidding chill in the air, a reminder of winter. Ice-cold spray blows in off Lake Michigan, stinging my cheeks and dampening the pavement under my sneakers. I jog all 18 miles of the lakefront path every morning, taking breaks whenever I can, not because I need them, but to admire the choppy gray-blue water of Lake Michigan. Even when it's cold, I always think about diving in, of swimming to the other side. I fight the urge, just like I fight the urge to keep pace with the neon spandex cyclists that zip past. I have to go slow. There are more than 2 million people in this city, and I'm faster than all of them. Still, I have to jog. Sometimes, I make the run twice to really work up a sweat. That's another one of Sander's rules for hiding in plain sight. Always appear to be weaker than I actually am. Never push it. It's dumb to complain. We've been in Chicago for 5 years, thanks to Sander's rules. 5 years of peace and quiet. 5 years since the Mogadorians last had a real bead on us. 5 years of steadily increasing boredom. So when a sudden vibration stirs the iPod strapped to my upper arm, my stomach drops. The device isn't supposed to react unless trouble is near. I take just a moment to decide what to do next. I know it's a risk. I know it flies against everything I've been told to do. But I also know that risks are worth it. I know that sometimes you have to ignore your training. So I jog to the side of the runner's path, pretending that I need to work out a cramp. When I'm finished stretching, I unsnap the tearaway-style track pants I've been rocking every jog since we moved to Chicago and stuff them into my pack. Underneath, I'm wearing a pair of mesh shorts, red and white like the St. Louis Cardinals, enemy colors here in Chicago. But Card's colors in Cubs territory are nothing to worry about compared to the 3 scars ringing my ankle. Baseball rivalries and bloody interplanetary vendettas just don't compare. My low socks and running shoes do little to hide the scars. Anyone nearby could see them, although I doubt my fellow runners are in the habit of checking out each other's ankles. Only the particular runner I'm trying to attract today will really notice. When I start jogging again, my heart is beating way harder than normal. Excitement. It's been a while since I felt anything like this. I'm breaking Sander's rule, and it's exhilarating. I just hope he isn't watching me through the city's police cameras that he's hacked into. That would be bad. My iPod rumbles again. It's not actually an iPod. It doesn't play any music, and the earbuds are just for show. It's a gadget that Sander put together in his lab. It's my Mogadorian detector. I call it my iMog. The iMog has its limitations. It picks out Mogadorian genetic patterns in the immediate area, but only has a radius of a few blocks and is prone to interference. It's fueled by Mogadorian genetic material, which has a habit of rapidly decaying, so it's no surprise that the iMog can get a little hinky. As Sander explains it, the device is something we received when we first arrived from Lorien, from a human Loric friend. Sander has spent considerable time trying to modify it. It was his idea to encase it in an iPod shell as a way to avoid attention. There's no track list or album art on my iMog screen. Just a solitary white dot against a field of black. That's me. I'm the white dot. The last time we tuned it up was after the most recent time we were attacked, scraping Mogadorian ash off our clothes so Sander could synthesize it, or stabilize it, or some scientific stuff I only half paid attention to. Our rule is that if the iMog sounds off, we get moving. It's been so long since it's activated itself that I'd started to worry that the thing had gone dead. And then, during my run a couple days ago, it went off. One solitary red dot trolling the lakefront. I hustled home that day, but I didn't tell Sander what had happened. At best, there'd be no more runs on the lakefront. At worst, we'd be packing up boxes. And I didn't want either of those things to happen. Maybe that's when I first broke the don't be stupid rule, when I first started keeping things from my Sepan. The device is now vibrating and beeping because of the red dot that's fallen into step a few yards behind me, vibrating and beeping in tune with my accelerated heartbeat. A Mogadorian. I hazard a glance over my shoulder and have no trouble picking out which jogger is the Mog. He's tall, with black hair shaved close to the scalp, and is wearing a thrift store Bears sweatshirt and a pair of wraparound sunglasses. He could pass for human if he wasn't so pale, his face not showing any color, even in this brisk air. I pick up my pace, but don't bother trying to get away. Why make it easy on him? I want to see whether this Mog can keep up. By the time I exit the lakefront and head for home, I realize I might have been a little cocky. He's good. Better than I expect him to be. But I'm better. Still, as I pick up speed, I feel my heart racing from exertion for the first time in as long as I can remember. He's gaining on me, and my breaths are getting shorter. I'm okay for now, but I won't be able to keep this up forever. I double-check the iMog. Luckily, my stalker hasn't called in backup. It's still just the one red dot. Just us. Tuning out the noise of the city around us, yuppie couples headed to brunch, happy tourist families cracking jokes about the wind, I focus on the Mog, using my naturally enhanced hearing to listen to his breathing. He's getting winded too. His breathing is ragged now. But his footsteps are still in sync with my own. I listen for anything that sounds like him going for a communicator, ready to break into a sprint if he sends out an alert. He doesn't. I can feel his eyes boring into my back. He thinks that I haven't noticed him. Smug, exhausted, and dumb. He's just what I'd been hoping for. The John Hancock building rises above us. The sun blinks off the skyscraper's 1,000 windows. 100 stories, and at the top, my home. The Mog hesitates as I breeze through the front door, then follows. He catches up to me as I cross the lobby. Even though I'd been expecting it, I stiffen when I feel the cold barrel of a small Mogadorian blaster pressed between my shoulder blades.
"Keep walking," he hisses.
Although I know he can't hurt me while I'm protected by the Loric charm, I play along. I let him think he's in control. I smile and wave at the security guards manning the front desk. With the Mog dogging my heels, we climb into the elevator. Alone at last. The Mog keeps his gun aimed at me as I hit the button for the 100th floor. I'm more nervous than I thought I'd be. I've never been alone with a Mog before. I remind myself that everything is going just as I planned it. As the elevator begins its ascent, I act as casual as I can.
"Did you have a nice run?"
The Mog grabs me around the throat and slams me against the wall of the elevator. I brace myself to have the wind knocked out of me. Instead, a warm sensation runs down my back, and it's the Mog who stumbles backward, gasping. The Loric charm. I'm always surprised at how well it works.
"So you aren't number 4, he says.
"You're quick."
"Which are you?"
"I could tell you," I shrug. "I don't see what it would matter, but I'll let you guess." He eyes me, sizing me up, trying to intimidate me. I don't know what the rest of the guard are like, but I don't scare that easy. I take off the iMog, laying it gently on the floor. If the Mog finds this unusual, he doesn't let on. I wonder what the prize is for capturing a guard.
I may not know your number, but I know you can look forward to a life of captivity while we kill the rest of your friends. Don't worry, he adds. It won't be long.
Good story, I reply, glancing up at the elevator panel. We're almost at the top. I dreamed about this moment last night. Actually, that's not quite right. I couldn't sleep last night, too keyed up for what was to come. I fantasized about this moment. I make sure to savor my words. Here's the thing, I tell him. You're not making it out of here alive. Chapter 2. Before the Moog can react, I punch a series of buttons on the elevator panel. It's a sequence of buttons that no one in the tower would ever have reason to push, a sequence that Sander programmed to initiate the security measures he installed in the elevator. The elevator vibrates. The trap is activated. My iMoog floats off the floor and, with a metallic clang, sticks to the back wall of the elevator. Before the Moog can blink, he's flung backward too, pulled by the blaster in his hand and whatever other metal objects he might be hiding in his pockets. With a crunch, his hand is pinned between his blaster and the wall. He cries out. Did he really think we wouldn't have protected our home? The powerful magnet Sander installed in the elevator is just one of the fail-safes, my Sepan, secretly built into the John Hancock building. I've never seen the magnet work as intended before, but I've definitely screwed around with it enough. I've spent hours with the elevator door wedged open, the magnet on, trying to bounce nickels from across the penthouse and get them to stick to the walls. Like I said, things have been kind of boring lately. It was a good game, until the tenants on the lower level started complaining. The Moog tries to wiggle his fingers, which are most certainly broken now, from underneath the blaster to no avail. He tries to kick at me, but I just laugh and hop away. That's the best he can do?
What is this?
He cries. Before I can answer, the elevator doors hiss open, and there is Sander. I've never understood my Sepan's affinity for expensive Italian suits. They can't be comfortable. Yet here he is, not even noon on a Saturday morning, and he's already dressed to the nines. His beard is freshly trimmed, clipped close. His hair is slicked back perfectly. It's like Sander was expecting company. I wonder if he was watching my run on the lakefront, and my stomach drops at the thought. I'm going to be in deep trouble. Sander is twisting a silencer into the barrel of a sleek 9mm. He glances at me, his expression inscrutable, then stares hard at the Moog. Are you alone? The Moog jerks against the magnet again. He's alone, I answer. Sander shoots me a look, and then pointedly repeats his question.
You expect me to answer that? Snarls the Moog.
I can tell Sander is pissed, but the Moog's answer causes a glimmer of humor to flash in my Sepan's eyes. Sander's mouth twitches, like he's fighting a laugh. I've sat through enough of my Sepan's beloved James Bond movie collection to know this Moog just provided a perfect one-liner opportunity. No, Sander says. I expect you to die. Sander raises the gun, before looking at me again. You brought him here, he says. Your kill. I swallow hard. I planned this whole thing out. It's been all I could think about since that red dot appeared on my iMoog a couple days ago. Still, I've never killed one before. I don't feel sympathy for the bastard. It's not that at all. But this feels like a big deal. Taking a life, even if it is only a Mogadorian. Will it change me? Whatever. I grab for Sander's gun, but he yanks it away. Not like that, he says, and drops the gun. I don't let it hit the ground. My telekinesis developed last month, and we've been practicing with it ever since. I take a deep breath, focusing my mind, steeling myself. I levitate the gun until it's level with the Moog's head. He sneers at me.
You don't have the
With my mind, I squeeze the trigger. The gun releases a muffled thwip. The bullet strikes the Moog right between the eyes. Seconds later, he's a pile of ash on the elevator floor. Sander plucks the gun out of the air. I can tell he's studying me, but I can't take my eyes off the remains of the Mogadorian. Clean that mess up, says Sander. Then, we need to talk. Chapter 3. I clean up what remains of the Moog as quickly as I can, not wanting to deal with building security wondering what's keeping the elevator. I scoop some of the ash into a plastic sandwich bag for Sander. He might want it for one of his experiments. For some reason, my hands won't stop shaking. I figure it's because I'm rushing, that the shaking will stop once I'm done cleaning the elevator, but it doesn't. It only gets worse. I stagger out of the elevator into the living room of our penthouse and collapse onto a white suede couch. Yes, I killed the Moog. Yes, it was even easier than I thought it would be. But it didn't feel how I thought it would. Something could have gone wrong. I can't shake the feeling of that Moog's fingers on my throat. Even though he couldn't hurt me, the sensation lingers. As the adrenaline drains away, all I can think about is what a stupid idea it was to engage the Moog. I'd wanted some action. I tried to be suave like the spies in those Bond movies. I think I put up a good front, not that the Moog will ever be able to tell anyone how badass I acted. My head swims as I gaze up at the gold chandelier that presides over the living room. I put this whole place at risk. Everything we've amassed in our years of safety, our home. Most important, Sander himself. I don't feel like celebrating. I feel like puking. Even now, Sander could be packing our bags. We could be headed back on the road. Before Chicago, all we did was travel. It was always hotels and motels. Sander never wanted to put down roots. He's not much of a housekeeper, doesn't cook or clean. Our needs were fulfilled by grouchy maids and room service. We spent a couple months at the Ritz-Carlton in Aspen. I learned to ski. Sander spent his time charming snow bunnies next to the fire. We spent some time in South America, eating the best steaks in the world. Our cover story was always the same as it is here in Chicago. Sander is a day trader who hit a hot streak and now lives comfortably, and I'm his latchkey nephew. I liked Aspen. It was good to be outdoors, without having to worry about a crush of people and which ones might be hostile aliens. After Aspen, it was a roach motel on the outskirts of Denver. I learned to judge how safe Sander thought we were by the luxuriousness of our accommodations. Although we could afford to live anywhere, thanks to the precious gems the Nine Sepans had left Lorien with, nice hotels meant Sander thought we were safe enough to live it up a little. Flea-bitten rat traps meant it was more important to lie low. If I'm being honest, I liked that place, too. That was where Sander tinkered with the vibrating bed, making it powerful enough to almost toss me to the ceiling. We moved whenever the hotel staff got to know us too well. As soon as we became a fixture, it was time to move on. That never helped. The Moogs always caught up with us. The last stop before Chicago was at a trucker motel in Vancouver. I still don't know how we got away that time. It was bad. 5 Moogs took us by surprise there. Sander had built weapons to keep us safe, flash bombs to blind the Moogs, a remote control helicopter with a very real gun attached, and still, we were almost overwhelmed. Sander got slashed by one of their daggers during the fight and barely had the strength to drive us south to White Rock. There, I sat by his bedside for a week while he slipped in and out of consciousness, his fever bad enough that I thought he might have set the sheets on fire if they weren't so soaked with his sweat. When he came to, Sander decided there'd be no more running. "We're going to try something different," he told me. "We've got the money. Might as well use it." I didn't know what he meant. "We're going to hide in plain sight." And we used the money. The 2-floor penthouse Sander purchased in the John Hancock building is like something out of that reality TV show where the celebrities show off their glamorous houses. as if installing a fish tank over their king-sized bed is going to help them when the Mogadorian invasion comes. Nothing wrong with fish tanks and hot tubs, but none of that stuff's any good without weapons. I know Sander loves it in Chicago, and so do I. But sometimes, I miss those days on the road. Sometimes, it seems like we should be doing more than just training. The half-dozen flat-screen televisions, the personal chef, the fully equipped gym, all this has only made me feel soft. Now, though, watching the sun glint off the angles of the chandelier, I realize how badly I don't want to leave this place. I rushed things. Yes, I want to take my place with the other guard. I want to kill every Moog I can find. But as restless as I've felt lately, I should probably try to enjoy my home for as long as I still have one. Eventually, my life will be nothing but fighting. Am I ready for that? I take a deep breath and pick myself up. The panic I felt before is gone, replaced by a sense of dread. I head down the hall to Sander's workshop, to face the music. Chapter 4. When I walk into his workshop, Sander is glued to an array of flat-screen monitors behind his desk. Various camera feeds from around the city are on display, archived footage from this morning frozen in time. I'm not surprised to see that I'm on every screen, the Moog from the lakefront visible behind me. With a few quick keystrokes, Sander deletes the video files, erasing my exploits from Chicago's memory banks. When he's finished with his hacking, there will be no evidence left of what I did this morning. Sander swivels around to face me. I get why you did it, dude. I really do. My Saipan peers at me, an array of frayed circuit boards and dismembered computer parts spread out on the desk between us. Stacks of unfinished or abandoned projects leave only a narrow path of floor between door and desk. Half-finished automatons, tricked-out weapons plucked from our arsenal, gutted car engines, and dozens of things I can't even identify. Sander loves his toys, which is probably why he's developed such an affinity for Batman. Sometimes, he even calls me his young ward, quoting Bruce Wayne. I could never get into comics. Too unrealistic. But I get that when he says it, it's some kind of joke. There's no joking now. This is Sander trying to be serious. I can tell by the way he drags his hand over his beard, searching for words. He hates that beard, but it hides the scar that the Moogs gave him in Vancouver. Just because I understand doesn't mean what you did wasn't stupid and reckless, he continues. Does this mean we have to move? I ask, wanting to cut to the chase. By the look on his face, I can tell Sander didn't even consider this. He's spooked, but moving never crossed his mind. And leave all this? He gestures to the piles of in-progress gadgets. No. We've worked too hard to set this place up to abandon it at the first sign of trouble. And the Moog was alone. I don't think our cover's blown quite yet. But you need to promise me you won't bring home any more guests. I promise, I say, flashing a Boy Scout sign I picked up from some television show. Sander smirks. It did get me to thinking, he says, standing up. Maybe you're ready to take your training to the next level. I stifle a groan. Sometimes it feels like all I do is train, probably because all I do is train. Before my telekinesis developed, it was endless days of strength training and cardio, broken up by what Sander calls practical academics. No history or literature, just more skills that I could potentially use in the field. How many kids know how to set a broken bone or which household chemicals will create an improvised explosion? Whatever complaint I might have made goes unvoiced when Sander brushes aside a pile of junk to reveal my lauric chest. He rarely opens it, and I've only seen him use a few of its items. I've been waiting for the day to learn everything that it contains and how to use them. Maybe I should have lured a Moog to our hideout sooner. Are you serious? I ask, still half expecting to be punished. He nods. Your legacies are developing. It's time. Together, we open the lock on the chest. I jostle in next to Sander, trying to reach my hands inside. So many new toys to play with. I see some kind of spiky green ball and an oblong crystal that gives off a faint glow. But Sander elbows me aside. When you're ready, he cautions, indicating the shiny mysteries waiting inside my chest. Sander hands me a plain-looking silver pipe, probably the most boring item in the whole chest, then snaps the chest closed before I can see anything else. Pretty soon, your other legacies will have developed. That means the rest of the guard, the surviving ones anyway, will be developing theirs too. I push aside the memory of the panic attack I had after killing the Moog, but Sander is looking at me with a steely glint in his eyes. He's not playing around. This might be fun now, but it won't be a game forever. It will be war. It is war. If you want me to treat you like an adult, you need to understand that. I understand, I say. And I do. I think. I turn the pipe over in my hands. What does this do? Before I can answer, the pipe extends into a full-length staff. Sander takes a step back as I accidentally knock a hollowed-out computer onto the floor. You hit things with it, says Sander, glancing worriedly at his fragile gadgets. Preferably, Moogs. I twirl the staff over my head. Somehow it feels natural, like an extension of myself. Awesome. Also, I think it's time you started going to school. My jaw drops. In all those years traveling, Sander never bothered to enroll me in school. Once we were settled in Chicago, I broached the subject, but Sander didn't want to distract me from my training. There was a time when I would have killed to go to school, to be normal. Now, the idea of mixing with human kids my own age, of trying to pass as one of them, is nearly as daunting as taking down a Moog. Sander slaps me on the shoulder, pleased with himself. Then he hits a button on the underside of his desk. A bookshelf, littered with dusty electronics manuals, makes a sudden hydraulic hiss and slides into the ceiling. A secret room. One even I was unaware of. Step into the lecture hall, my young ward, intones my Sepan. Chapter 5. What Sander calls the lecture hall isn't like the classrooms that I've seen on TV. There are no desks, no places to sit at all, really, with the exception of a cockpit-looking chair built into one wall. Sander calls it the lectern, and he climbs into the seat behind a control panel of blinking buttons and gauges. The room is about the size of our expansive living room, all white, every surface tiled with what looks to be retractable panels. My footsteps echo as I walk to the center of the room. How long have you been working on this? Since we moved in, he replies, flicking a series of levers on the lectern. I can feel the room hum to life beneath my feet. Why didn't you tell me? You weren't ready before, says Sander. But you proved to me today that you're ready now. It's time to begin the last phase of your training. I'd lured the Moog to our penthouse because I wanted to show Sander that I was ready for more action. I'd wanted to show him that I could act independently, that I could be his partner. No more of his young ward crap. But this is just more of the same. I thought I was ready to graduate. Instead, Sander has decided to stick me in summer school. Just a few minutes ago, I was worried that I'd made a bad decision of life-altering magnitude. Now, listening to Sander patronize me, I'm reminded why I stayed up all night planning that Moog's demise. For all his big, serious pep talk, Sander just doesn't get me. I regretted the possibility that I'd put this place in danger to prove my readiness, but the more I watch Sander play around with his gadgets and levers, the less sorry I feel about what I did. Shall we begin? He asks. I nod, not really paying attention. I'm tired of play fighting. I got a taste of the real thing this morning, and it might not have gone exactly as I expected, but it was still better than this. Hell, real school with soft human kids would be more exciting. I'm part of the guard. I have a destiny, a life to start leading. How many stupid training sessions will I have to endure before Sander lets me start living it? A panel on the front of the lectern opens, discharging a trio of steel ball bearings at fastball speed. I easily deflect them with my telekinesis. This trick is played out. Sander's been shooting objects at me pretty much non-stop since my telekinesis developed. Before the first trio can hit the ground, though, two more panels open in the walls on either side of me, both firing more projectiles. Caught in a crossfire, I use my telekinesis to ground the ones to my left, instinctively swinging my pipe staff in a tight arc to bat away the others. "Good!" shouts Sander. "Use all your weapons!" I shrug. "Is that it?" Sander sends another volley of projectiles my way. This time, I don't even bother with my telekinesis. I use the pipe staff to deflect two of them, quickly spinning away from the others. How does the staff feel? I twirl my new weapon effortlessly from hand to hand. It feels natural, like a part of myself I didn't know was missing before today. I like it. On Lorien, they held competitions with those things. They call them jousts. In his younger days, your father was a champion. It's rare for Sander to mention life before the Mogadorian invasion, but before I can grill him further, a section of the wall juts out at me like a battering ram. It's too heavy to stop with my telekinesis, so I throw my weight into it and roll across it. I land on my feet, supporting myself with my staff, and am greeted by a floating drone that looks like something Sander made by attaching a helicopter propeller to a blender. Before I can properly size up the drone, it bobs in close and zaps me with an electrical shock that sends me tumbling back over the battering ram. The shock isn't enough to really hurt me, but it sends pins and needles through my limbs. Sander laughs, delighted that one of his creations scored a hit. His laughter just makes me angry. I hop back to my feet, only to immediately duck another volley of projectiles. Meanwhile, the drone has bobbed out of staff range. I focus on it with my telekinesis. From behind, a heavy punching bag on a chain detaches from the ceiling, slamming into me with the weight of a grown man. The wind is knocked out of me, and I crash to the ground. My face hits the floor in the fall. Instead of seeing stars, I see droplets of blood from my split lip pooling on the polished white floor. I wipe my face and scramble to one knee. Sander looks at me from behind his control panel, an eyebrow raised mockingly. "Had enough?" Still seeing red, I snarl and make a lunge for the drone. It's not fast enough. I impale it with my staff in a shower of sparks. I shake the broken drone off the end of my staff and stare at Sander. "Is that all you've got?" Chapter 6. The workout in the lecture hall lasts 2 hours. 2 hours of flying ball bearings, electrified drones made of scrap heap parts, and whatever else Sander thinks to throw at me. At some point, my mind shuts off, and I just react. I'm pouring sweat. My muscles ache, but it's a welcome relief not to think for a while. When it's over, Sander pats me on the back. I hit the showers and stand under the hot water until my fingertips are wrinkled. It's dark when I emerge from my bathroom. I can smell Chinese takeout in the kitchen, but I'm not ready to join Sander yet. He'll want to talk about the training session, about what I could be doing differently and better. He won't mention this morning's Moog killing. Just like any time we argue, it'll get ignored until we cool down and forget about it. I don't want to start the routine yet, so I stay hidden in my room. The lights in my bedroom turn on automatically, motion sensors detecting my presence. If I had any friends, I'm sure they'd be sick with envy of my room. I have a king-sized bed that faces a 52-inch flat-screen television, and the TV is hooked up to all three of the major video game systems. There's an awesome stereo with speakers mounted on the walls. My laptop sits on my desk next to the Beretta that Sander lets me keep in here for emergencies. I catch sight of myself in the mirror. I'm wrapped in a towel and can see the bruises and scrapes on my torso and arms, all courtesy of today's training. It's not a pretty sight. I turn off the lights and walk over to the floor-to-ceiling windows. I press my forehead to the cool glass and look down at the city of Chicago. From this height, the wind is so strong that you can see it shake the blinking lights on the rooftops as it whips around them. There's non-stop movement below. Cars plodding along, ant-sized humans darting between them. I did something reckless today because I thought it would prove something. Instead, it's just sucked me in deeper to the same routine. Sander thought he was rewarding me with that lecture hall session. But really, it was just more monotony. I turn my gaze away from the masses of people below, out toward the dark sheet of Lake Michigan. If one of my legacies turns out to be flying, I'm just going to take off. Go someplace where there are no Mogadorians, no Sepans telling me what to do. No anything except me and Sky. But I can't fly. At least not yet. I get dressed and join Sander for dinner. Chapter 7. A few nights later, I dream of Lorien. I feel energy course through me, almost like working out in the lecture hall, but different. It's a giddy feeling, like a never-ending sugar rush. In the dream, I'm a kid, younger than I can even remember being. And man, am I running. I'm booking it through the woods, my legs pumping for all they're worth. Two creatures that look like wolves, but which have massive falcon wings jutting out of their backs, are nipping at my heels. Chimera. My chimera. It has rained recently, and the ground squishes under my bare feet. I break into a recessed clearing that's slick with bright white mud. The closest chimera clips my heel, and I go tumbling onto my stomach, rolling through the mud, covering my clothes and face. The chimera stands over me, pinning me as I pant and catch my breath. He leans down and sloppily licks my cheek. I laugh harder than I can remember laughing in a long time. The other chimera cocks his head back and howls. I roll between the chimera's legs and hop to my feet. I lunge at him with a guttural war cry that strains my lungs. I wrap my arms around his neck, burying my face in his fur, and try to swing my leg over his back. The other chimera gently bites the seat of my pants and pulls me back into the mud. I dig my fingers into the wet dirt, then lob two misshapen balls of slime at the chimera, the stuff splattering across their snouts. They howl. Springing to my feet, I run back the way we came. The chimera race behind me as I weave through the trees. I might not remember Lorien, but the young body I'm in knows it well. I'm just along for the ride, as my young self tromps through stalks of knee-high grass, bare feet knowing just when to hop over errant tree roots to avoid tripping. A campfire appears in front of me. Sitting by it, a burly man with a bushy black beard cooks our dinner over the fire, his sleeves rolled up past his thick forearms. Somehow, I know his face. My grandfather. Next to him is a fresh-faced man I don't immediately recognize. He's dressed way too nicely for the outdoors. It's Sander. I guess I never realized how young he was when we were on Lorien. My grandfather sees me coming, grinning, and has the good sense to get out of the way. Sander isn't paying attention. He's got his eyes glued to some kind of mobile communicator. Probably messaging a girl back in the capital about watching the fireworks later. Some things don't change. I tackle him around the knees, dragging him down into the dirt, my mud becoming his mud. He cries out, the calm flying from his grip. I sit on his chest, my arms folded. Conquered, I declare. Not yet, pal, Sander replies, his eyes lighting up. He grabs me under the armpits and lifts me up, spinning. In the distance, from the direction of the city, there comes a low rumbling. With that, my grandfather accidentally drops our dinner into the fire. I wake up, feeling happy and sad at the same time. Chapter 8. It's been a week since my last visit to the lakefront, and there hasn't been so much as a peep from the IMOG. I get up at dawn to find Sander already sitting at the kitchen counter, holding a cup of coffee. That's unusual. My Sepan normally prefers to sleep until mid-morning, sometimes not even waking up until I've returned from my run. He's always been a night owl, and it's only gotten worse since we moved to Chicago. I know that sometimes he slips out at night and comes home smelling like perfume and booze. I don't ask him about these trips, just like he doesn't ask about my runs. I guess we just both need some private time, although he apparently has been keeping an eye on my private time, if the video footage he had on screen the other day is any indication. I study his face, the bags under his eyes, the growth of beard hiding his scar. I try to find some resemblance to the young man I saw in my dream, but that person is gone. I never thought about the fact that Sander had a life before he came here. I don't remember Lorien. At least I thought I didn't. But I know Sander remembers it. He must miss it. I wonder if he still sees a giddy, mud-covered menace when he looks at me. Probably not. Sander notices that I'm wearing my running clothes. We agreed to keep a low profile for a while, but I can't stand another day trapped in here with just the lecture hall, video games, and overwatched spy movies to pass the time. "Going for your run?" he asks. I grunt a yes, acting casual as I slug back some orange juice from the container. I don't think that's a great idea. I turn to face him. "What are you talking about? Need I remind you that last week you brought home a Moog from the lakefront? Maybe it's time to change things up?" I slam the refrigerator door harder than I mean to, rattling our vast assortment of condiments and takeout containers. "I'm not staying cooped up in here all day," I state. "You think I'm not tired of looking at that sour mug of yours 24/7? Asks Sander, arching an eyebrow. "Think again." He lays a laminated card on the counter. "I got you this." The card is a membership for something called the Windy City Wall. There's an unsmiling picture of me in the bottom corner of the card, next to my most recent alias, Stanley Worthington. I thought it might be good for you to get out and meet some people that aren't Mogadorian scouts. Lately, you seem sort of... He trails off, rubbing his beard, not sure how to proceed. "Thanks," I reply, and jog out the door before he can finish his thought, eager to escape. Neither of us has ever been much for sappy heart-to-hearts. I'd prefer to keep it that way. The Windy City Wall is a sprawling rec center about 20 minutes from the John Hancock building. I've probably passed it 100 times before today, but I've never once considered going inside. These kinds of places are reserved for humans. And besides, I have plenty of training equipment back home. After all these years, why has Sander chosen now to sign me up for something like this? I wish that I'd let him finish his thought and tell me what I seem like lately. There's a smiley tour guide at the front desk who shows me around the center. There are basketball courts, a pool, and a gym that I'm surprised to find is as well equipped as ours. Besides all that normal YMCA-type stuff, there are also a variety of obstacle courses, with cargo nets and old rubber tires meant to simulate various natural obstructions. And then, of course, there is the wall. It's no wonder the rec center takes its name from it, because it's absolutely huge, dominating an entire side of the building and rising up some 40 feet from floor to ceiling. The rock is fake, and obviously there's no blue sky in this warehouse-like building, but there's still something majestic about the wall. When my tour guide is done rambling, I head straight for it and take my place in one of the lines, behind a bunch of kids who look just a little older than me. Above us, a boy that I take for about 17 is stuck in the middle of the wall, casting around desperately for a handhold. He can't find one, and after a few seconds of flailing, he drops off, his descent slowed by a safety line and cushioned by a pillowy mat. "Is this your first time?" I glance over my shoulder. A tall, blonde-haired boy about my age is smirking at me. I nod. "Yeah, This is the advanced end. You probably want to start with easy. No, I don't. The blonde kid exchanges a look with the shorter kid next to him. The short kid doesn't look as strong as his buddy, but he's compact, which should make him a better climber. You'll need a vest, says the short kid. I laugh. The idea of me falling off this wall after the training I've had is ridiculous. I smile at the short kid, assuming that he's joking, even though both he and his friend are wearing vests. I don't need one of those. Tough guy, jokes the blonde one. No, seriously, it's the rules, says the other. Even if you were Sir Edmund Hillary, you'd need to wear a vest. I stare blankly at the kid. I have no idea who he's talking about. He was the first person to climb Everest, the short one explains. Oh, I mumble, the mountain. Both boys snicker. Yeah, the mountain. The short kid nudges the tall one. Why don't you go get the new kid a vest? The tall kid gives me a weird look, then jogs off to an equipment rack. I realize this is one of the longest conversations with human kids I've ever had. I wonder how I'm doing. I'm Mike, says the short kid, shaking my hand. My friend is also Mike. Is everyone in this city named Mike? That's funny, says short Mike, but he doesn't laugh. What's your name? Stanley. I don't hesitate, producing my alias easily, as if it's my real name, just like Sanders drilled me to do. Tall Mike returns and hands me a vest. I pull it over my head, and they show me how to adjust the straps. So, Stanley, continues short Mike, practically interrogating me, where do you go to school? I'm homeschooled. That explains your sparkling personality, deadpans short Mike. I think he just insulted me. Before I can respond, I notice her. She's in the next line over. Maybe 16 or 17, straight black hair, and eyes to match. She's athletic-looking, not like some of the flimsy girls I've seen jogging along the lakefront. She's beautiful, and she's staring at me. How long has she been watching me? Has she been listening to my entire conversation with the Mikes? When she sees that she has my attention, the girl quickly looks away, her cheeks reddening. I can't help it. I can't look away. Eventually, she glances back my way and nervously flashes me a tentative smile. I can only blink in response. Tall Mike waves his hand in front of my face. What? I snap. It's your turn, bro. I turn and see the climbing instructor sarcastically tapping his watch. I step forward, and he buckles the safety cords to my vest. I'm barely listening as he explains where the best handholds are, my mind too busy trying to figure out why that girl was staring at me. Instinctively, I try to straighten my mess of hair. I don't know what to think about that girl. On TV, there's always music that plays when a guy makes eye contact with a pretty girl. I'd kill for some soundtrack now. I wonder if she likes guys from other planets who can climb walls really fast. Guess I'll find out. The instructor blows a whistle, and I leap onto the wall. The start of my ascent is clumsy. I should have listened when the instructor explained the handholds. Even so, I quickly find a rhythm and begin swinging my body up the wall. Is the girl watching? I have the unbearable urge to check. I glance down. She is. She's standing right next to the two Mikes, both of them nattering at her. She ignores them, watching me. No, more than watching me. She's studying me, like I'm the most interesting book in the world. My palms are suddenly slick with sweat. That's not good. I realize too late that I've worked myself into the same trouble spot as the first climber I watched. I'm about halfway up the wall, but there's no handhold close enough to reach above me, and backtracking is out of the question. There's only one handhold I can see. It'd be out of the reach of a human. With my strength, though, I can probably make it. I'll have to jump for it. I hunker down on my footholds, putting as much weight as I can on my knees and hips, before springing upward. I grab the handhold and my sweaty fingertips scrabble across it. Then, it is gone. I'm falling. I can't believe this. I'm falling. Defeated by a human wall and some sweaty palms. The safety ropes slow me down and the mat cushions my fall. It isn't my body that's hurting. It's my ego. I lie on the mat, not wanting to get up and face the eyes of the rec center. Her eyes. Tall Mike peers down at me. Guess you did need the vest, he says with a smirk. Short Mike helps me off the mat, telling me it was a good first try. I'm barely listening. My eyes sweep the room, looking for the girl. She's gone. Chapter 9. I keep my head down when leaving the Windy City Wall. I've spent pretty much my entire life in anonymity, but even when I've been on the run from killer aliens, I've never wanted to avoid attention as much as I do now. I know it's ridiculous. Kids must fall off that wall all the time. Yet I'm sure that everyone in the gym is secretly laughing at me. I take the long way back to the John Hancock building, and then walk past it. I keep replaying my fall in my head. I imagine seeing myself from that girl's perspective. Flailing, sweaty, legs kicking uselessly at air. I pass the entire day in a daze, beating myself up, and the sun is setting when I finally decide to go home. Sander is in the living room when I get there, lounging in a leather recliner with some boring-looking book about advanced engineering in his lap. Perfect timing, he says when I enter, waving his empty martini glass at me. He doesn't notice my slumped shoulders as I cross to the room's fully equipped bar. I pluck Sander's empty glass from his hand, using my telekinesis. Then I levitate bottles of gin and vermouth, mixing them through ice. The most difficult part is using my telekinesis to get the olives on the little plastic sword. I can mix a cocktail with my mind, but I can't climb a damn wall. When I'm finished, I walk Sander's martini over to him and flop down on an adjacent couch. He tastes the drink, smacking his lips. Pretty good, he says. So, how was it? Fine, I grunt. Just fine. You were there all day. I hesitate before telling him more, but I need to confide in someone, and Sander has way more experience with the humans, with girls, than I do. I fell off the wall. Sander chuckles, not looking up from his book. You? Really? I wasn't paying attention. I mean, I guess I got distracted. You'll get it next time. He shrugs. There won't be a next time. I'm silent, one arm draped across my face. Sander must realize I'm holding back details, because he finally closes his book and leans forward. What happened? His voice lowers. Did the IMOG detect something? No. I pause. There was a girl. Oh, he says, drawing it out. Even with my face covered, I can tell he's grinning. He rubs his hands together. Was she pretty? She was beautiful, I say, looking away. I fell because she... I don't know. She was, like, watching me. Checking you out. Giving you the eye. Shut up. So a beautiful young thing saw you fall, and now you're embarrassed. I have no comeback. When he says it like that, it sounds so juvenile, like something from one of those TV shows where humans in too much makeup mope around and make longing faces at each other. But he's exactly right. Sander gives my shoulder a squeeze. "'Tis but a minor setback, my young ward,' Sander opines. "'I can tell you one thing for certain. You're not going to impress your lady by moping around here.' "'Who says I want to impress her?' He laughs. Come on. Who doesn't want to impress beautiful women? Right now, in her mind, you're just a guy that bit off more than he could chew. If you don't go back, though, you become that wimp she saw fall off the wall one time. Do you want that? I don't even have to think about my answer. I'll go back tomorrow. Chapter 10. I'm up early again the next morning, back in the lecture hall, dodging projectiles and batting drones out of the air with my pipe staff, even though my mind is at the Windy City Wall. Sander doesn't take it easy on me, despite knowing that I want to be conserving my energy for a second chance at impressing that girl. "Keep your head in the game!" he shouts at me after a mechanized tentacle trips me up. After training, I shower thoroughly, even though I'm just getting ready for another workout. I want to look good. I even run a comb through my tangled thatch of hair. Sander's been ragging on me forever to cut it, telling me that I look like a girl and recommending all kinds of hair products that would give me maximum hold. I've never paid any attention to his unsolicited style tips. Only looking at myself in the steamy bathroom mirror, I wish I'd listened to him. I look like a caveman. But it's too late to do anything about my hair now. Besides, I figure showing up with a fresh haircut glistening with pomade, whatever that is, would look pretty desperate. "Good luck," says Sander knowingly, as I head to the elevator. There are butterflies having a heavy artillery firefight in my stomach as I jog over to the rec center. I breeze in the door and immediately beeline for the equipment rack, grabbing a safety vest as I confidently stride toward the advanced end of the wall. I casually scan the room, looking for the girl. She's not there. In fact, the place is nearly empty. Ugh, it's a school day. I always forget the humans keep much different schedules than I do. There are a few college-aged kids working out on the wall, getting envious looks from flabby older guys who are probably here on their lunch break. I join them. Might as well get a few practice runs in. I spend an hour mastering the wall. This time I listen to the instructor, paying special attention to where the best handholds are. By the time the hour is up, I've successfully scaled the wall a half dozen times. According to the instructor, if I shaved a few seconds off my time, I'd have a shot at breaking the local record. I don't tell him that I haven't been going all out, that with my Lorik strength and speed, I could easily smash it. I'm saving that performance for when the girl shows up. There's still about an hour left before school gets out. It'd probably look pretty weird if I was already here when the other kids arrive, and I decide I want to make an entrance. I imagine confidently strutting into line, ignoring taunts from the mics, then flying up the wall in record-setting time. While the mics are busy picking their jaws up off the floor, I'll stride over to the girl, her adoring smile inviting me to talk to her. And then, well, I haven't totally planned out the talking part yet. I buy a bottle of water from a vending machine and head outside. There's a small park across the street from the rec center, where I make myself at home on a bench, the perfect spot for a stakeout. I'm comfortable in the cool air and have a good view of the Windy City Wall entrance. I'll hide out until kids get out of school, and then it'll be time for my redemption. The thought of a stakeout causes me to check my iMoog. An evil red dot appearing nearby is exactly what I don't need right now. Luckily, the coast is clear. I spend the next hour trying to think of a good opening line. All the guys in the movies and on TV have them when they approach a girl. I should have asked Sander for one before I left. He probably has whole books filled with pickup lines. By the time I see the two mics enter the Windy City Wall, I still haven't come up with anything good. I'm stuck on climbing puns, but they all come off pretty gross, like I want to climb on her. "Is this seat taken?" A girl's voice interrupts the conversation I'm having in my head. Distractedly, I wave at the empty space of bench next to me. "The next wall I'd like to climb is the one around your heart." "How's that?" "Really, really cheesy."
"Hi," the girl says, sitting down next to me.
And that's when I realize it isn't just any girl sitting inches away from me on the bench. It's the girl. Her cheeks are rosy in the late spring air, her black hair gently blown in the breeze. She's smiling at me. She's so beautiful. I suddenly feel like I could throw up. This wasn't the plan.
"I'm Maddie," she says, extending her hand.
I just look at her, my mind completely blank. So much for first lines.
Maddie squints at me. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your, quiet muttering.
Was I muttering? I must look like a crazy person. I try to recover.
No, you're not interrupting. I was just thinking.
Oh, she says, looking at me expectantly. I realize her hand is still hanging out there between us, waiting for me, so I grasp it, squeezing her hand a little too eagerly. I'm Stanley.
Nice to meet you, Stanley.
I swallow hard. This meeting is already way off track. She wasn't supposed to see me again until I'd beaten the wall and restored my pride. I make a half-hearted gesture toward the rec center, desperately trying to recreate the scenario I'd been envisioning. I was about to go climb. Do you want to come watch?
Watch?
She asks, arching an eyebrow. Maybe we could race. If you're up for it, she adds, teasing me. I flashed back to my humiliation of the day before, suddenly lost for words. Luckily, she bails me out.
Anyway, she says, I actually can't stay. I'm on my way home. I just saw you sitting over here by yourself and thought I'd say hey.
Oh, I say, lamely.
Hey.
Hey, she repeats. And then comes an awkward silence, almost like Maddie's nervous, too. Her gaze bounces away from me, and her mouth screws up, as if she's trying to figure out what to say. I wonder if she plans conversations out in her head, too. When she speaks again, her words are a torrent of nervous energy.
I saw you yesterday, and you were by yourself then, too, and that's totally cool if you like working out alone, but I'm new here, and it's been sort of hard to meet people, so I figured maybe we could, like, team up and fight solitude together.
I blink at her. I can't believe my luck.
Sorry, she says, rolling her eyes. I'm not usually this much of a spaz.
You're not a spaz, I reply.
Okay, good. I've got you fooled.
She laughs nervously. Okay, shut up, Maddie.
Here.
She reaches into her bag and hands me a piece of paper with her name and number scribbled on it.
If I didn't just totally freak you out, you should call me, she says, hopping off the bench before my idiot brain can even form a reply.
Chapter 11. Wind whips around us as we stand on the roof of the John Hancock building, sending the drone that's floating above me and Sander listing momentarily downward. We're trying out his newest creation, a hollowed-out toaster with steel glider wings protruding where the bread slots should be. I brush my gloved fingers across the drone controls, correcting its course against the wind. Its tiny motor hums sharply in response. We always take Sander's new creations for test runs, knowing they might one day be our only allies against a horde of Mogadorians. In the meantime, I'll most likely end up staring down this latest buzzing contraption in the lecture hall.
So, says Sander, how long has it been since you got her number?
I keep my eyes on the drone.
5 days, I reply.
The humans have a rule about calling girls, muses Sander. Something like waiting 3 days unless you want to look desperate.
I grunt.
You're in the clear as far as that goes, he concludes.
What are you waiting for?
What's the point? I ask, trying not to sound as sullen as I feel. I don't think I pull it off. Ever since our meeting in the park, I've done little but train and think about Maddie. We only spoke for a couple of minutes, but I could tell that she's lonely like me. She's new in Chicago, and even though I've been here for 5 years, for all the socializing I've done, I might as well be new too. Admittedly, I've fantasized about having a social life that's more than playing robots with my Sepan, but I never dreamed that a beautiful girl would come along, much less be interested in me. Now that it's actually happening, what can I even do about it? Maddie doesn't have any scars on her ankle. She hasn't been conscripted into an intergalactic war. She'll make friends in the city eventually, go off to college, live a normal life. Me? I've got to make a race of warmongering monsters accountable for the genocide of my people. It's nice to think about escaping all that, to daydream about having a girlfriend and going on dates, Except one day, the daydream ends, and I go to war. How does getting to know a human fit into that, let alone having a girlfriend? It doesn't. Sensing that my mind is elsewhere, Sander eases the controls out of my hands and brings the drone back to the roof. He puts his hand on my back, and we walk over to the edge of the roof and peer down at the city below us. "You can never escape who you are," he begins. "I know that," I say, wanting to cut short whatever kind of exasperating pep talk he has in mind. "I don't know what's gotten into him lately." "Listen," he continues, "just because you've got a destiny doesn't mean you don't also have a life to live." "That's not what it feels like." He sighs. "Maybe I've made a mistake with you, keeping you so isolated. If that's the case, I'm sorry. I guess I forgot what it's like to be young." Sander rubs his beard, searching for words. "I've had some, friends since we've been on Earth." "Friends," I snort. "Is that what those girls are?" "Whatever," Sander says with a nervous cough before elbowing me. "The humans can be a welcome distraction, that's all I'm saying." "I don't need a distraction," I say sarcastically, and kick the drone. "I have video games and toy robots." "That's not the point," Sander continues. "Distraction, that's the wrong word. They can be a reminder, too. A reminder that what we're doing, why we're here and fighting, that it's worth something. We can have lives, Nine. When we win this war, and we will win, you can be Stanley for real, or someone else, even. You can be whoever you want." My eyes sweep across the city. Out there, somewhere, are the Mogadorians. Even if the one from the lakefront was the only one in Chicago, there are others, hunting me. You can't escape what you are, but you also should know what you could be, why you're fighting. Also out there, probably doing homework in her parents' apartment, is Maddie. I'd much rather think about her than the Moogs. "Call her," Sander says. "Be Stanley, even if it's only for a little while." I glance over at him. I can see how hard he's trying to reach me. I want to believe that he's right. "Thanks, Sander." He pats me hard on the back. "Just don't screw it up." Later, I sit on my bed with the door closed, holding the phone. This time I don't bother rehearsing, not after how badly that went for me last time. I just take a few deep breaths and dial Maddie's number. She answers on the first ring. "Hi," I say, trying out the words. "It's Stanley." There's a sigh of relief on the other end. Maybe she's been thinking about this moment too, hoping I would call. "I was beginning to think you weren't going to call," she says. I can almost hear the smile in her voice, and I instantly feel better.